From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Political columnist George Will used to oppose congressional term limits, but now he supports them. On today's Fresh Air, George Will tells us why he changed his mind. It's the subject of his new book, Restoration. We'll also talk about the presidential race, TV pundits, and how Will went from supporting Kennedy as an undergraduate to supporting conservative causes in grad school. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording by the Myra Melford Trio. Melford is a petite woman who breaks stereotypes every time she sits down at the piano and plays her forceful, percussive music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Drug Enforcement Administration claimed today that it dealt a crippling blow to the Colombian cocaine cartels by arresting more than 150 narcotics traffickers worldwide. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Locked in a tight presidential race and after having spent billions of dollars in the war on drugs, the Bush administration unveiled Operation Green Ice. Justice Department officials hailed it as an unprecedented international anti-drug effort involving eight nations. $44 million and more than 1,000 pounds of cocaine were seized, as well as seven of the leading financial managers of the Cali cocaine cartel. DEA Administrator Robert Bonner said the drug cartels had been dealt a serious blow.
These monies are their lifeblood. They must have this cash in order to finance the production and distribution of cocaine. They must have it in order to corrupt and to be able to intimidate.
Despite the success of Operation Green Ice, U.S. officials said it would be naive to expect that one such effort would have a serious impact on the availability of drugs on American streets. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The latest ABC News Washington Post poll shows Democrat Bill Clinton slipping in his lead over President Bush. The latest poll shows Clinton leading by only 9 points compared with a 21-point lead just a week ago. The survey of more than 600 voters showed Governor Clinton with 51% to the president's 42% in a two-way matchup. The poll had a margin of error of 4.5 percentage points either way. The poll also showed that Clinton has the most to lose if Ross Perot revives his presidential campaign. In that race, the poll showed Clinton with 44%, the president with 39%, and Perot with 14%. The Russian government has announced that it's sending a new contingent of troops to Tajikistan after serious fighting broke out there over the weekend. Several dozen Russian soldiers were taken hostage. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The dispatching of fresh Russian troops to strife-torn Tajikistan in Central Asia marks the first time since the collapse of the Soviet Union that Moscow has formally deployed troops outside Russia's borders. In response, according to Tajik radio, protesters have gathered outside the Russian embassy in Dushanbe, Tajikistan's capital. The situation in Tajikistan has deteriorated rapidly over the past 3 days, especially in the southern city of Kurgan-Tube, where fighting between opposition forces and troops loyal to the deposed former president has taken scores of lives. The Russian Defense Ministry in Moscow said it is sending new troops to Tajikistan to help defend the Russian military and civilian population living there. Over the weekend, more than 30 Russian soldiers were taken hostage by rival Tajik forces. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street, recovering a bit from last week's decline. The Dow Industrials gained 26 points to close at 3,276. This is NPR. Federal disaster officials said today that they should have the power to respond to disasters such as Hurricane Andrew, even when the stricken states don't ask for help. Wallace Stickney, the head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, said today that states sometimes lose valuable time because they're slow to acknowledge that their own resources have been overwhelmed. Stickney said that FEMA must be proactive in responding to disasters. FEMA has been bitterly criticized for being slow and badly organized in its response to disasters such as Hurricane Hugo and the Los Angeles riots. The State Department said today that it has new eyewitness accounts to back up earlier reports that as many as 3,000 Bosnian Muslim men, women, and children were executed at Serbian detention camps last May and June. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the administration now has two accounts from former prisoners in a brick factory near Brčko in northeastern Bosnia. They claim to have witnessed the murders of up to 50 prisoners at a time. Boucher said one prisoner reported that on several occasions he helped transport bodies of dead prisoners to a local animal rendering plant where they were cremated. The two prisoners have independently estimated some 3,000 men, women, and children were executed in the May-June period. The administration has passed this information to the UN and the International Red Cross so they can investigate the charges more fully. U.S. officials continue to push for a UN resolution to set up a war crimes commission. The commission would establish the facts and prepare for possible prosecution of individuals found guilty. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has asked Russia's highest court to excuse him from testifying in a trial over the banning of the Communist Party. Gorbachev said that such testimony would make him a pawn in a political struggle. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, George Will, is one of America's foremost columnists and commentators. He's been described as a national version of the smartest boy in the class. One of the frustrations he has been spared in his life is not getting his opinions heard. He writes a syndicated newspaper column, a column in Newsweek, and he's a panelist each Sunday morning on ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. Will won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism in 1977. A little later, we'll talk about how Will went from supporting Kennedy in college to becoming one of America's leading conservative journalists. But first, we're going to focus on the subject of his new book, Restoration, in which he argues that term limits are necessary to restore Congress to competence and respect. Will supports limiting members of the House and Senate to no more than 12 consecutive years. Will says he came slowly and reluctantly, but firmly, to accept the need for term limits. He told me what finally convinced him.
Several things. The accumulated weight of the evidence of how Washington works, or more precisely does not work, how it budgets or fails to conduct the fundamental act of governance, which is to budget, the unwillingness to make rational choices. Then there were some specific episodes. I had always opposed term limits on the grounds that we needed what were called seasoned professionals here in Washington and couldn't have amateurs. It was pointed out to me that etymologically the word amateur comes from the French word to love and means someone who does something for the love of it, and that didn't seem to me like such a bad motive, even in public life. I concluded that it was seasoned professionals, and because they were seasoned professionals that gave us the deficits we have and the savings and loan debacle and much else. Furthermore, I had opposed term limits on the grounds that the lobbyists would run roughshod over the rookies if we had a constant rotation in office. But then I noticed, particularly in California, when they voted on Proposition 140 limiting their state legislative terms in 1990, that the people who opposed them most ferociously were the lobbyists. And I noticed that in Washington, the group most adamantly opposed to term limits are lobbyists, because they have long-term, mutually beneficial relationships with career legislators who are tamed, wired, and rented by these people. And they don't want anything to disturb this very comfortable, I believe, ruinous relationship.
Why do you think term limits would make it easier for people in Congress to cast unpopular votes?
Because they would not be afraid. They would not be as risk-averse. They would be people probably who came to Congress from other careers, who would know coming into Congress that they had to have careers to go back to. And therefore, the prospect of losing an election would not be personal annihilation and oblivion. Therefore, they could think of the next generation and not simply the next election.
You've talked about the mediocrity of American presidents. Do you think that presidents who are subjected to a two-term limit maybe disprove the theory? Do you know what I mean? That with term limits, politicians improve?
I don't think so. I think the executive branch poses its own problems relative to the legislative branch. But first of all, how many presidents have we wanted for four more years after what we've had? Not very many. I think most people would agree that after 8 years, an administration is stale. The people who came with the president are tired. The ideas are exhausted. Indeed, you could argue that you're seeing today a third term of a sort of pale imitation of Ronald Reagan, and the exhaustion's manifest.
Well, this is a year of real house cleaning in the Congress. There are so many incumbents who aren't running and so many newcomers who are. So do you think that there's a natural process going on now that maybe would make term limits unnecessary?
No, quite the contrary. What this year's turnover demonstrates is it takes a concatenation of highly unnatural circumstances to break the logjam. Normally, we have enormous numbers of incumbents seeking re-election, and 98% of those seeking re-election winning it. Indeed, since 1948, I believe only four times has the re-election rate for incumbents dipped below 90% and only as low as 86%. What you've got this year is redistricting, a law that allows people retiring to take private for their own benefit remaining campaign funds, the House check cashing scandal, the House post office scandal, and an unprecedented level of general disgust. I, for one, do not want to rely on this kind of constellation of disasters to produce regular rotation in office. And what strikes me is how many people, including a lot of opponents of term limits, say, you see, you don't need term limits because we're having this wonderful turnover. Well, if it's wonderful, let's institutionalize it.
And you think that this is just
a
function of the scandals and it's a fluke.
That's right.
What about the argument, why not let the good people stay and just vote out the bad ones?
It's very hard to vote out an incumbent because the modern state lends itself in all its myriad regulating and subsidizing activities to becoming an incumbency protection machine. The vast majority of campaign contributions go to incumbents simply because they are so apt to win. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy on the part of the interest groups. In 1990, almost half the incumbents running for re-election were either opposed or, as they say, financially virtually unopposed. That is, their opponents, they either had no opponent or their opponent had less than $25,000. That's a derisory amount. They're simply not competitive. So it's extremely difficult to compete with people who can use the modern state to shower their constituencies with favors. You see, I believe that the founders were right not to include term limits. It is a restriction on choice. You shouldn't restrict choices unless it's necessary. What then has made it necessary? It is the intersection of human nature with the nature of the modern government.
But you could still be a career politician even if there were term limits, because you could go from the House to the Senate. You could start your career. You could have a long career in city and state politics before even going
precisely,
to national politics.
Precisely, and that is indeed what the normal career pattern was from the time of Jefferson until early into this century, when the state began to grow and Washington became worth staying in and indeed became comfortable enough because it had air conditioning and all the rest, that people wanted to make lives here. Indeed, some of the term limit initiatives on state ballots this fall say that you can run, say, if you're restricted to six terms in the House, 12 years. Some of the initiatives say you can run for a seventh consecutive term, but you have to do it by write-in. You can't receive a major party nomination for a seventh term. It's worth noting that term limits are on 15 state ballots this year, including such large states as Ohio, Michigan, Florida, and California. These 15 states have about a third of the American population, and as the Wall Street Journal pointed out just the other day, this is as close as we have come in American history to having a national referendum on a subject.
Do you think in a way that the larger problem might be the quality of people politics is attracting now?
I think it is. You know, a great many of the best people in Washington, the kind of people who, if we're going to have career politicians you wish would make careers of it, are now leaving. And they're leaving because, paradoxically, the climate of careerism, the smallness, the inability to make large decisions, the preoccupation with individual political entrepreneurship on the part of careerists has made life here simply unpleasant. I'm thinking of, say, a man like Vin Weber, 40-year-old Republican from Minnesota, has just thrown up his hands and said, this is not the way I want to spend my life.
You said you came to this idea reluctantly. Why were you reluctant to be on the side of term limits?
Because I'd been on the other side vociferously. I mean, I'd written a number of columns with customary verve and certitude against term limits. But more than that, as a conservative, I'm very reluctant to change the Constitution. That's something one should do with trepidation, in part because of the law of unintended consequences, which is one reason why a number of us conservatives are conservatives. The law of unintended consequences being that the unintended consequences of a reform are apt to be larger than and diametrically opposed to the intended ones. And term limits, you know, is a peculiar reform because you know going in, you know that one of its absolutely certain results will be unfortunate. And that is, it will truncate some excellent careers. I have dedicated my book to two couples who are among my best friends, Liz and Pat Moynihan and Jack and Sally Danforth, Republican and Democratic senators, who've been here longer than my proposal would permit them to stay. But I just have to face the fact, I think on balance, the good outweighs the bad.
You were very briefly in politics. In 1970, I think it was, you worked for the senator from Colorado.
Gordon Allott, that's right.
Yeah. So what got you into politics and what got you out very quickly?
Well, I was teaching. I taught for a year at Michigan State and then for a year and a half at the University of Toronto teaching political philosophy. And got invited to come to Washington and work for a senator. And I said, well, that'd be fun. So I came down. Liked it here. In 1972, in my third year with him, he lost. He'd won 5 statewide elections till I went to work for him. I don't know what that says about my help I gave him. But anyway, he lost, and so I decided to stay in Washington and became a columnist. I loved Congress, and I certainly harbor no animus against Congress. The title of my book, Restoration, is meant to indicate that I want to restore Congress to the primacy I think it rightfully has under the Constitution as the first branch of government. It is, after all, Article I, and it is the initiator of laws, the passer of laws, the initiator of spending. It's the most important branch, and one of, I would hope, one of the consequences of term limits would be to shrink the presidency back to its proper constitutional proportions. You know, it's fascinating to me that television and the Cold War arrived in America almost simultaneously and had the reinforcing effect of inflating the presidency. Television is a slave to a superficial news-gathering instrument, a camera. The camera has to be pointed at something. It's often pointed at the president. It's just a simple way to solve your problem with that device. And the president has been on this bright, well-lit stage in this international melodrama, followed around for 40 years by the man, the military aide, carrying the nuclear launch codes. The whole effect was to inflate the presidency and put Congress into an anti-constitutional eclipse. And it's that I would hope term limits would help to rectify.
Yeah, well, along those lines, what do you have to say when the president accuses Congress of, causing a gridlock and preventing his legislation, when the people in Congress were elected as much as the president was?
Well, I agree with
they're
that.
They're doing the people's will as much as the president is.
I agree with that. Furthermore, I think the American people are voting for gridlock. When the American people produce, as they have for 40 years, almost constantly for 40 years, divided government, I don't think it's a fluke. The political scientists have a formulation. They say the American people are ideologically conservative and operationally liberal. That is, they think of themselves, and when voting for president, use their vote to make a kind of ideologically defining statement. They think of themselves in Jeffersonian terms, that government is best, that governs least, and all that. Then they turn around, and when they vote for senators on down to city council, the people who actually legislate bridges and roads and pensions and medical care and teacher salaries and all the rest, then they have a voracious appetite for government. They just have a negligible willingness to pay for it. And therefore, in a sense, we're the system that's producing gridlock that looks as though America has a very divided mind is in fact representing, it's a representative process. It's representing accurately the turmoil in the national mind.
Do you think if we did have term limits, that those limits would encourage more intellectual, philosophical people to run for office?
I think so, because they would not look upon term limits on a career in politics, the way people look on a career in selling aluminum siding or shoes or hardware or dentistry or veterinary medicine or anything else. It wouldn't be just a vocation. It would be a departure from the pattern of your life that you would make because you cared about something, not just keeping your job, but issues, reforms you'd like to see affected, something wrong with America that bothers you and you'd like to correct. You'd come, take a crack at it, and then leave the way people used to.
One of the really big problems now is, in order to run for office, you really have to be pretty wealthy. And don't you think that's one of the fundamental problems in politics now, that it's this real limited group of people who even have access to office?
It certainly is the case that the Senate is, shall we say, amply stocked with millionaires. It is not quite the same way in the House, but it's getting that way, that the alternative to being wealthy is to spend all of your time raising money. Indeed, if you're wealthy in the Senate, you spend all of your time raising money. The estimate now is that on average, and of course the averages vary from, say, Vermont to California and the expensiveness of a Senate race, but on average, a senator seeking re-election has to begin the day he's elected and raise $10,000 a week every week for the next 6 years. It's a grueling, degrading, demoralizing process.
If you're just joining us, my guest is George Will. He's written a new book called Restoration, Congress, Term Limits, and the Recovery of Deliberative Democracy. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. George Will is my guest. He's written a new book about congressional term limits. It's called Restoration. You recently wrote about how presidents are so often mediocre now, and you called President Bush the weakest incumbent to seek re-election since Andrew Johnson in 1868. You've described Clinton as so far the weakest challenger since John Davis, the man who took Democrats 103 ballots to nominate in 1924. And more recently, you wrote, the search for reasons to re-elect George Bush resembles for many the 19th century search for the source of the Blue Nile, hard going. So how are you deciding between the two of them?
With trepidation, I'm going to put it off as long as possible.
So you really haven't made up your mind?
I genuinely haven't. And I think in this regard, if in no other, I'd rather reflect the American public. Normally, the rule of thumb is that when the campaign turns the corner past Labor Day, that only at most 20% of the country is truly undecided, so that all the miles traveled and money spent in that period is aimed at influencing 20% of the country. This year, I think it if you count the very, very soft attachments to both candidates, it could be as much as 50%.
You weren't exactly enthusiastic about George Bush when he ran in 1988 in a column about the 5,000 reasons to support George Bush. The 5,000 reasons were the 5,000 people who were presidential appointees in one way or another. You figured, well, at least they'd be Republicans. Has he surprised you in any way?
No. Alas. I mean, my expectations were so low that almost any surprise would have been on the positive side. No, what I hold against George Bush is not what he, as they say, has done to the economy. I don't think presidents run the economy. I don't think they can. I don't think they should try to. I think we have business cycles, with or without presidents. He made some mistakes that injured the economy a bit. But basically, the economy was going to have a rough patch here. What I object to about Mr. Bush is what he's done to our politics. He has drained it of ideas. And when you drain politics of ideas, cynicism fills the vacuum. And you have these manipulators. He goes into what he calls his campaign mode, which to him means it has nothing to do with what he'd do if reelected. And that's I think we have a politics without the ballast of conviction.
Do you consider President Bush to be more cynical than the average politician?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, consider the contrast with his predecessor. One doesn't have to agree with a syllable that Ronald Reagan said. You can still concede the fact that he was, in the phrase the British coined really to apply to Margaret Thatcher, a conviction politician. The world is divided between those who go into politics because they want to be something and those who go into politics because they want to do something. Reagan wanted to do something. Mr. Bush, I'm afraid, wanted to be something.
You wrote that today honorable conservatives feel the sort of fury felt by honorable conservatives 40 years ago when Joe McCarthy was giving anti-communism a bad name. Who are the conservatives that honorable conservatives feel embarrassed by now?
Well, Pat Buchanan, in some of his modes, proclaiming a religious war in this rather tranquil and happy country. Pat Robertson saying that, in fact, the Clintons, he and she, have devised a strategy to destroy the American family. I mean, one, I can make the case against Bill Clinton as well as the next guy, but it's preposterous to say that that is the case against them.
How comfortable are you with the alliance between conservatives and the religious right?
Well, the evangelicals come in many shapes and sizes, and the religious right does too. When the involvement of the religious elements of American society and politics was Jesse Jackson and Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Congress, no one saw anything wrong with that. It's when the religious communities in America became alarmed by some cultural trends and wound up in the Republican Party that people began to find this ominous. I don't find it ominous. I believe that cultural issues from abortion through the caliber and nature of our public education are quite legitimate political issues. They're questions about how we ought to live. So I'm not alarmed by that. I'm alarmed by the temperament of some of the representatives of that camp. But the phenomenon itself is not disturbing.
Do you think that some of the representatives of that camp are trying to blur the distinction between church and state?
Well, they may be, but they won't get anywhere. I mean, if there is any constitutional principle that is settled and sturdy at the moment, it is the Supreme Court's insistence on what Jefferson in that famous letter referred to as the wall of separation between church and state. The court has developed that three-prong test for testing the constitutionality of any state action touching religion. And so the idea that an election result might result in a theocracy in the United States is not a worry I entertain.
Each Sunday, you and Sam Donaldson ask very sharp questions to politicians and political leaders, and then you have a very spirited discussion about the issues of the day, joined by other people. I wonder what you think of the kind of pundit shows that are much more theatrical in nature, like McLaughlin's show and Evans and Novak's show.
Well, I don't see Evans and Novak often. I've seen the McLaughlin show a few times, and enough to know that it seems to have earned its nickname as the gong show of journalism. I don't think it's consonant with the basic dignity of political discourse. I mean, political discourse can be vigorous, Lord knows, without being so cacophonous that it's hard to follow. And second, without giving the impression, a dangerous one for the profession of journalism, without giving the impression that there's an act going on, that it's vaudeville carried on by other means, that people have sort of assigned roles and come out and mud wrestle on cue.
Do you think that there is a shortage of public conservative intellectuals or of conservative intellectuals that are used on broadcasting?
No, I don't. I think actually we're doing rather well on the conservative side in opinion journalism, particularly if you count the op-ed pages of America's newspapers. Frankly, I think I'm the only person who's ever had what I've got at the moment, which is a regular network television exposure, the back page of a national news magazine, and a syndicated column. Sapphire, Buckley, Buchanan, Patrick, Kilpatrick, lots of others. In fact, if I were an editor of a newspaper, I'd probably be most anxious to find fresh liberal voices.
George Will is a political columnist and a panelist on ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. His new book about congressional term limits is called Restoration. George will be back with us on the second half of today's show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, part two of our discussion with political columnist George Will. Will is one of America's most admired conservative journalists, but back in his college days, he headed a group of students for JFK. He'll tell us about his political conversion. We'll also talk about interviewing politicians on television and the image Will created with his trademark eyeglasses and bow tie. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us why he thinks Myra Melford's Out There trio is ready for popular acclaim. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Dallas, Ross Perot met today with members of both the Bush and Clinton camps about their respective economic plans. The Texas billionaire had no comment about whether he will get back into the presidential race, insisting that the answer lies with his supporters, who have placed his name on the ballot in all 50 states. Earlier, Perot had indicated that he would announce by Thursday whether he would get in the race. Two of South Africa's most well-known prisoners have been released as a result of talks between President F.W. de Klerk and African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela. One of the prisoners opened fire on a crowd 4 years ago, and his release is seen as balancing the release of an ANC supporter jailed for a fatal bomb attack. Virgil Keane reports for the BBC.
Robert McBride was mobbed by cheering ANC supporters as he walked out of the gates of Westville Prison in Durban. Although he can hardly be described as a major political figure, his release has great symbolic importance, representing to the ANC's grassroots a significant concession extracted from the government. At a news conference after his release, McBride expressed regret for the bombing in which three women were killed, but said if the conditions in South Africa reverted to those of the mid-1980s, he would take up arms again. Another convicted killer released under the terms of the amnesty, right-wing extremist Baron Stradom, who expressed the view at his trial that black people were not human, was originally given multiple death sentences for the murder of seven blacks and an Indian in Pretoria. He is now apparently set to profit from his activities. An Afrikaans Sunday newspaper has bought exclusive rights to his story in what's being described as a lucrative agreement.
Virgil Keane reporting for the BBC. Officials have announced that General Motors and the United Auto Workers Union have now reached a tentative contract settlement, ending a four-day-old strike in Lansing, Michigan. Doug Johnson of Michigan Public Radio reports.
The 4,200 members of UAW Local 602 walked off the job Friday after failing to reach a settlement with General Motors. The strike at the Lansing body plant quickly shut down production of GM's popular Pontiac Grand Am, Buick Skylark, and Olds Achieva. The terms of the settlement have not been released, and 602 President Ted Hartman will say only that agreement on all outstanding issues has been reached. Hartman says workers will not return to the plant until after the contract is approved by the entire membership during a meeting tomorrow evening. UAW officials have said one of the key issues was GM's decision to eliminate 300 jobs at the plant by changing the way breaks were taken. For National Public Radio, this is Doug Johnson in Lansing, Michigan.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 26 points to close at 3,276.26 on volume of more than 157 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, shelling of the capital continued today, and three people attending outdoor funeral services were killed. 20 other people were wounded. Yesterday, pumps to the city of Sarajevo's water supply reportedly were turned off, leaving several hundred thousand people without water. 1 week ago, at peace talks in Geneva, it was agreed upon not to use water and electricity as weapons against civilians. Power to the capital was cut 1 day after that agreement was made, and continued fighting has blocked efforts to repair the power lines. In South Florida, electrical power has now been restored in all areas capable of receiving it, 5 weeks after the area was battered by Hurricane Andrew. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
Hurricane Andrew knocked out electricity for nearly 1.5 million residential and commercial customers of Florida Power and Light. Each passing day since August 24th has brought more and more customers online, and now FPL spokesman Bill Swank says the only homes and businesses without electricity are those too damaged to receive it.
They may have had water inside their walls and in their wiring systems. They may have had a lot of the electrical circuits destroyed or damaged by the storm.
Swank says there are an estimated 25,000 FPL customers in that category, most of them in the hard-hit area of southern Dade County. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
Officials say that a Pakistani jet crashed while landing in Nepal and all 167 people on board were killed. The Airbus 300 struck a hill about 8 miles south of the airport at Kathmandu. 2 months ago, a Thai jetliner hit a mountain after trying to land at the same airport. More than 100 people were killed in that crash. The airport has no radar, and planes are guided in by radio beacons. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. George Will has written a new book, Making the Case for Congressional Term Limits. It's called Restoration, and we discussed it in the first half of today's show. Will is back to talk with us about politics, journalism, and his own political evolution. Will writes a syndicated newspaper column, a Newsweek column, and he's a panelist each Sunday morning on ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. When you're interviewing newsmakers on The Brinkley Show on Sundays, do you think that they come in with a sense of what it is they're going to tell you that's going to make news? I mean, do you think that they've spoken to their aides and said, okay, we'll tell them this, but we won't tell them any more than that?
Oh, I think so. I think they know why they're coming on our show. I sometimes wonder why anyone does come on our show. I
mean, what makes you wonder that?
Well, what's in it for them? I mean, they have Will and Donaldson and Brinkley are there to try and get them to say something that will make news. Now, generally, that means say something indiscreet, controversial, inconsistent with what they've said in the past. Something that, I mean, I'm not saying we're being cynical about this, but something that moves along, advances the public conversation in this country.
Mm-hmm.
A politician wants to control the pace and evolution of that public conversation. And he has a great many ways, he or she has a great many ways in political life of getting their views out. They can hold press conferences, they can issue press releases, they can give set speeches. Why come on and do it on our show? I'm glad they do, believe me. I mean, it keeps us in business. But at times I wonder. Now, clearly one reason they do is that on Sunday morning we have a very, not a huge, but a quality audience. And it's a way of getting in the Monday papers, of dominating a slow news day, of getting your view out. So, of course, they should have, if they're going to come on our show, they should have a kind of media strategy that they're advancing. And if they're good, and frankly, by the time you get senior enough in American public life that a show like The Brinkley Show wants to have you on, you are good at it. They will come on, and it doesn't matter too much what we ask them.
Now, I'm interested in your political evolution. I believe your parents were Democrats, and I know in 1960, when you were at Trinity College, you headed the Trinity Students for Kennedy. So obviously, when you were younger, you weren't yet conservative. Can you tell us something about the formative experiences in your life,
it's all
personal and political?
It's in 1 Corinthians. Then I put away childish things. Well, actually, it's interesting you ask that because in recent days, President Bush has been saying the problem with Clinton is he went to Oxford and became a left-winger. I went to Oxford between 62 through 64 and came back and voted for Goldwater. So Oxford can have different effects on you. I went to England. I saw the Berlin Wall, which was rather young at that point. I watched in England what I took to be the suffocating effects of a recklessly growing state of collectivism, both in the Tory Party and in the Socialist Labor Party. Became acquainted with the writings of Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek, and indeed some sort of Hayekian people at a little group in London called the Institute of Economic Affairs, which was nourishing the intellectual growth at that time of a young politician from the Midlands named Margaret Thatcher. So I was sort of present in England and at Oxford when free market economics and the kind of conservatism that we associate with that was gaining an intellectual pedigree.
So free market economics was the first thing to change in your political philosophy.
Well, it was the belief that government is a blunt instrument, that markets are remarkably equitable and efficient allocators of wealth and opportunity. Then I did come back and went to graduate school at Princeton and then went into teaching. So I was on college campuses, here or abroad, as an undergraduate, graduate student, or professor all through the 1960s. And I am one of those whose conservatism owes something to the student radicalism of the 60s, when I became quite struck by the ferocity of the passions loose and of the fragility of institutions such as universities.
So did you feel that as the campuses kept becoming more radical that...
I kept getting more conservative.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What about cultural ideas? Did they... was that simultaneous with your political change? Did you change culturally as well?
Well, I did. I became convinced that it is part of government's job to look after certain values, certain moral attributes that are the prerequisites of, are assumed for democracy. I actually, by 1981, when I gave the Godkin lectures at Harvard and then produced a book called Statecraft to Soulcraft, I'd formulated this, saying that, in fact, government cannot help but take sides on certain broad cultural questions. We do it with what we criminalize or decriminalize, with what kind of schools we have and who goes to the schools and what we teach and all the rest, and through our civic liturgy, what we encourage, what we reward, what we praise, and that we ought to think about it, because indeed democracy does presuppose a complicated, subtle network of values and capacities on the part of the public that tyrannies needn't worry about.
My guest is political columnist George Will. He's written a new book about congressional term limits called Restoration. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is George Will. He's the author of a new book called Restoration, Congress, Term Limits, and the Recovery of Deliberative Democracy. Now, in an article in Esquire magazine, William Henry III called you a national version of the smartest boy in the class. Were you the smartest boy in the class during grade school?
Good God, no. I don't remember grade school. I went to the university high school on the University of Illinois campus in Champaign-Urbana. And I was far from the smartest kid in my class.
How did you do?
I did all right, but I think we had a small class of about 33, and I think a third of them were merit scholar finalists. I certainly wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents encourage you to do a lot of schoolwork, your father being a professor, your mother a high school teacher?
I don't think so. I think all I cared about was baseball, and I played basketball with stunning badness, but I played it. And I couldn't have played at a larger school, so I was really interested in sports.
You know that thing about the image of being the smartest boy in the class? You know, on television, one of the things that's given you that image is the glasses that you wear, the bow ties that you used to wear.
My 11-year-old daughter says that I look like the perfect nerd, so I think that has something to do with it.
Well, I wonder if you ran into the kind of Gloria Steinem problem in the sense that once the media and the nation associates you with a certain pair of glasses, you cannot change them.
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting. I used to wear bow ties a lot just because I liked them, and it came to seem to be a kind of statement or a costume, so I haven't worn them so much recently.
Mm-hmm. And the glasses?
Actually, these glasses... I got in Aspen at a place, and I think they were originally made for John Denver. Seriously, I think they were trying to make John Denver look more grown up. And they designed these, and I'm not sure whether he wanted them or not, but anyway, I got them.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I think that's the case. It's been a while.
And you're not kidding about that?
No, to the Aspen Optical Shop. I'm sure they could tell me if I called them up.
Do you think that the nature of your conservatism has changed over the years?
I'm a little more skeptical of government than I once was. I once was, in fact, when I wrote Statecraft to Soulcraft, I was a little more sympathetic to the welfare state and to what I was trying to define strong government conservatism. I am less sanguine today about the modern state as an instrument of reform and as a supplementer of market forces. And that's one reason why I'm for term limits.
You have a son who has Down syndrome, and I wonder if that's affected your thoughts at all about government responsibility for caring for others.
It has made me sympathetic to families who didn't have the means that I have to provide for him, even if the government hadn't been there. I've made good use, I hope and think, for my son of public services, particularly in Montgomery County, Maryland, and I'm very grateful to the to Montgomery County and the other jurisdictions that have provided services for him. And as I say, I've been particularly alert to how anguishing it would be if I had no alternatives. And so people less fortunate than I understand how desperately important these are to them. It's a classic example of where government doing things that people cannot do for themselves.
I want to ask you something that's really old news, but I just want to kind of get your sense of it. During the 1980 president debate, you were a participant in the coaching of Ronald Reagan, and you were very criticized by that by many journalists who felt that you had kind of breached the line between journalism and politics, and that what made it worse was that you analyzed the debate for ABC television without mentioning that you had coached Ronald Reagan. So what are your thoughts about that now, looking back on
it? Well, I shouldn't have done it. It does breach a line. I should say it's a line really drawn for my benefit. When Walter Lippmann was coaching Adlai Stevenson and others, and when Edward R. Murrow was giving Adlai Stevenson television lessons, the line wasn't drawn then, but it got drawn with some clarity for my benefit, and I'll accept the line as given. The idea that Ronald Reagan needed a lot of coaching from the likes of me is, of course, preposterous, but what I did was I participated in the debate preparation, asking him questions, and not long and not many, but some, and I shouldn't have done it. I'm not quite racked with guilt over the fact that I then went on to analyze the debate for two reasons. First of all, it was hardly a state secret who I was in favor of. And indeed, I'm sure I was on Nightline that night representing the conservative media that supported Reagan. Second, what I said after the debate was that Reagan won it decisively, and he did.
Where was your mind changed? Because after the debate, when you were called on this, you defended your action, and now you're saying that lines like that are drawn for the benefit of journalists. So,
this line was drawn for my benefit.
Right.
Because when others were supporting liberals, they didn't care. To be blunt.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. See, there was no uproar when Edward R. Murrow coached Adlai Stevenson, or when Walter Lippmann was involved with all kinds of people. He was a very active participant in the political process. But I think people got a little exercised when a conservative was involved.
But anyways, when did your mind change about the...
Well, when I saw how the controversy did confuse people and they said, well, what are the rules and shouldn't we have a cleaner demarcation? And I said, fine, that probably is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, the effect of the end of the Cold War on your politics and your priorities, I mean, you became a conservative during the Cold War. It was the beginning of the wall in Germany. The wall's a thing of the past, the Cold War is a thing of the past. Has that fundamentally changed you in any way?
Well, it's opened up wonderful, inspiriting possibilities that, indeed, we can, as I say, restore Congress, shrink the presidency, revitalize our democracy, dismantle some of the national security state. I hasten to stress that I think the Cold Warriors of both parties are the great heroes of American history. It's the most important war ever waged, and... the Cold Warriors come out of it covered with glory. And I had from Truman and Acheson through Reagan and his supporters. There's nothing wrong with the Cold War, but it did inevitably have a distorting effect on the structure and conversation of the federal government. And it's good to be back to being just a normal country in a normal period again, rather than the vanguard of a of a resistance to a nation that considered itself a different historical stage, the Soviet Union.
One last question for you. One of the things that you're very well known for is always quoting political historians and philosophers and so on. Do you, when you come across a quote that's of interest to you, have a place that you could store it in so that you can get access to it when you want to refer to it?
No, I don't use computers or word processors over there. I write everything with a fountain pen, so I don't store things. Usually if I quote something, and I think I do it less than I used to and less than people think, but usually when I quote something, that tells you what I'm reading at the moment.
What are you reading at the moment now?
Right at the moment, I'm reading a novel called Clockers.
Oh, Richard Price's novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah, it is.
And
Now tell me why you're reading that. That's really, it's a novel about teenagers selling crack cocaine and about the police who police the neighborhood.
Yeah, well, it's sort of Bonfire of the Vanities without the cartoonish element. I mean, this is real American realism of the sort Tom Wolfe advocates. And it does what literature does. It takes you into a world that is strange to you.
Would Richard Price, the author, ever end up on the Sunday Show?
It's conceivable.
Right.
Sure. And I may write a column. I'm a little late now on this, but it's the sort of novel I sometimes write columns about.
Right. Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Glad to.
George Will writes a column for Newsweek as well as a syndicated newspaper column. He's a panelist on ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. Will has written a new book in support of congressional term limits called Restoration. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on Ross Perot's meetings today with people from the Bush and Clinton camps?
Well, I can't tell you at the moment, but I can assure you that we'll have absolutely the latest on whatever Mr. Perot is doing. It's still quite confused. He seems to have the whole world of national politics sort of swirling around him at this present time. John Itzde will explain the deficit reduction plan that Ross Perot has proposed, and we promised to play long excerpts from the candidate speeches. And tonight we'll have about 8 minutes from Bill Clinton, an appearance stopped last week in Georgia. Also, Lynn Neary talks with members of the group Drink Me from New York. It's a duo, and their music is, to say the least, a bit idiosyncratic.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says pianist Myra Melford played a lot of nice music in the late 1980s, working mostly in a duo with flutist Marion Brandis. But it wasn't until Melford put together a jazz trio in early 1990 that her playing really took off. Kevin thinks her combination of lyricism, adventurousness, and hard swing might make her some real money.
Let's start by owning up that most jazz critics, this one included, couldn't smell commercial potential if it was wearing cheap aftershave. That said, I keep thinking Myra Melford is ripe for popular acclaim, if only by the jazz world's modest standards. I've seen her trio play a lot, at home in New York and out on the road, and audiences really eat it up, even when the music gets a little rambunctious. All right, not too much of that or you get the wrong idea. Melford can really play that stuff, but it's only part of what she does. On her second trio album for the Enemy label, called Now and Now, you can hear her varied musical background, her classical studies, her experience playing with forward-looking jazz composers like Butch Morris and Leroy Jenkins, the Latin music she hears in her New York neighborhood, and the blues licks she picked up living in Chicago. Despite Melford's eclectic outlook, her music doesn't come off as a postmodern pastiche of different styles. Her stuff sounds organic and natural because she hears the connections among different musics. She understands the relationship between the dense clusters free jazz pianists bang out and the way blues piano players approximate the blue notes that lie between the cracks in the scale by striking adjacent keys at the same time. Melford's dissonances are easy to take because her trio's rhythmic grooves can get as infectious as the old Ramsey Lewis trios. You remember his hit, The In Crowd? 2/3 of the credit goes to her superior rhythm section, bassist Lindsey Horner and the terrific drummer Reggie Nicholson. The pianist writes almost all her material and has a knack for catchy tunes. Myra Melford's best compositions unfold like good pop songs. She'll take a single melodic figure, a hook, and keep rephrasing it. Since that's basically what the trio does when they improvise on a melody, the transitions between the written and improvised parts are seamless. A couple of Melford's major key tunes are a little new age chipper for my taste, but that's no big problem once the trio starts tearing into them. And it's not like those wholesome melodies make her music harder to take. Now, if record buyers made a habit of taking advice from jazz critics, Harry Connick Jr. would be waiting tables, and Mujal Richard Abrams would be a household name. But I'm telling you, whether you like your jazz pretty or hard-edged, this is a group you want to check out.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator in New York. He reviewed Now and Now by the Myra Melford Trio on the Enemy label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Toohey, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Welcome to our new researcher, Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with General Norman Schwarzkopf. In his new memoir, Schwarzkopf claims that hawks in the Bush administration pushed to start a land offensive against Iraq before troops were ready and before diplomatic efforts were exhausted. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.